Good afternoon, everyone. I want to begin by checking with our colleague, Judge Rovner. Can you hear and see us in the courtroom okay?
Yes, and you both look wonderful.
As do you. Thank you. It's great to see you. Okay, we have one argument on this afternoon's calendar. It comes in appeal number 24-1945, Calvin Lee versus Milwaukee County. And we'll begin with Ms. LaBella. Nice to see you.
May it please the court, Maria LaBella on behalf of Calvin Lee. The district court erred in granting summary judgment to the county. This case involves tribal issues of facts that should have survived summary judgment. I'll begin with the healthcare claim. As the sworn record reflects, Mr. Lee received no meaningful mental health treatment for 2 years despite serious diagnosed conditions and repeated requests for care, including a hunger strike. Under this court's decision in Miranda v. County of Lake, pretrial detainee medical claims are governed by an objective unreasonableness standard. A jury could find that sustained non-treatment of Mr. Lee's mental health conditions to be objectively unreasonable and reflective of a broader customer practice. As this
Ms. LaBella, forgive me, but was Lee evaluated by a mental health care professional at intake to see what mental health needs he had? And if so, did any mental health care professional state that he needed a long-term therapy?
There is no record evidence that upon intake, Mr. Lee was evaluated by a medical professional. Upon intake, it was documented to the county that and made known to the facility's medical personnel that Mr. Lee suffered from and was being actively treated for certain conditions, but he was not evaluated by a professional, at least not as there's any evidence in the record to support.
Ms. LaBella, while we're on that topic, can I just ask you a follow-on question? What Mr. Lee himself seems quite clear that he was suffering from PTSD and other related conditions, kind of coming out of his traumatic brain injury. But other than his own assertion that he needed long-term mental health care, what actual evidence is there in the record that clinically he needed that?
Well, Mr. Lee's sworn affidavit indicates that these were diagnosed conditions by a medical health professional and that prior to intake, he had been actively treated for those conditions by a professional.
So beyond his word, his word does mean something, I'll give you that. But beyond that, did he produce his medical records, for example, from VA clinics or otherwise?
At some point, he did turn over his medical records to the county, but the records themselves are not part of the record.
Would you agree that Mr. Lee was not entitled to long-term therapy just because he said he needed it? In the same way that he's not entitled to any particular medical treatment just because he asserts he needs it. So, I mean, could you enumerate whatever you think is in the record regarding this situation?
Yes, Your Honor. We agree that inmates are not entitled to long-term therapy simply because they assert they need it. But Mr. Lee's in a very different position. He's in a position where he's been diagnosed with very serious conditions. And this court recognized in Wellman that a two-year psychiatrist vacancy can violate the Eighth Amendment. So this court has recognized, in other words, that where inmates suffer from serious diagnosed conditions, there can be some entitlement to treatment for mental health, or at least that it raises a tribal issue for the jury to decide. And as to Mr. Lee's lockdown claims, even during a pandemic, Bell requires that restrictions not be excessive in relation to their purpose. Here, Mr. Lee challenges two types of lockdowns, the duration and severity of which raise a tribal issue on excessiveness. The first type of lockdown was a sustained COVID-era regime, as described in the supplemental appendix, page 9, paragraph 11, for 7 months from December 2020 through July 2021, the jail confined detainees on a 26.5-hour rotating schedule. The second type of lockdown were the recurring mass lockdowns in 2022, some lasting up to 44 hours at a time. Based on this court's prior lockdown and exercise jurisprudence, including Delaney v. Detella, Locke v. Jenkins, and Davenport v. DeRobertus, among others, where lockdowns of comparable duration and severity raised constitutional issues even under the Eighth Amendment's higher standard, and where the defendants relied not on COVID in particular, but on institutional security, the lockdowns at issue here raise a tribal fact issue on excessiveness under the 14th Amendment.
Now, would you tell us if you think there's a difference between the lockdowns that occurred pre-July 2021 and post-July 2021?
Yes, there were factual differences between the two sets of lockdowns. With regard to the first set, it was a 26.5-hour period of rotational confinement. So
that's not, forgive me, but it's not exactly the thrust of my question. In other words, look, in the beginning, before July 2021, the whole world was locked down, so to speak. You know, people weren't even leaving their houses to get groceries. Beaches were closed. Parks were closed. People were wearing masks outside, et cetera, et cetera. So why don't we hone in post-July 2021?
Yes,
Your Honor. When testing and vaccines were widely available.
Yes, Your Honor. Insofar as the pandemic carried on and everyone was learning, including facilities, how to respond to it, we do think at that point the county's case for deference had weakened somewhat. So we do believe that there are, you know, even slightly weaker justifications with respect to the second set of lockdowns. However, we do believe that both set of lockdowns raise a tribal issue on excessiveness under Bell.
On the on that second set of lockdowns that Judge Rovner was asking you about, what evidence is there, though, that there were, that they were anything other than episodic, and episodic in response to either a health condition flare-up or some other, you know, situation that was arising in the Milwaukee County Jail? In other words, what would lead us to believe that that beyond episodic, they actually reflected, you know, policy or custom and practice of the institution?
They were custom and practice, Your Honor, because of how recurring they were. So Mr. Lee cites several instances of these lockdowns occurring. And further, the severity of the lockdowns, because they went on for greater than 23 hours and up to over 44 hours at a time, that indicates that the county was not simply responding to discrete events in the prison, or at least if it was, it wasn't doing so very well. And there were certain lockdowns, as reflected in Mr. Lee's grievances, where the county didn't provide any explanation at all in response to Mr. Lee's questions as to why it was locking inmates down for such prolonged periods. And as to Mr. Lee's sanitation claims, conditions must be evaluated holistically. The record evidence viewed favorably to Mr. Lee describes extended confinement alongside repeated unsanitary conditions, most notably periods of disabled toilets and lack of functional plumbing, limited access to clean water and cleaning supplies, and exposure to human waste and mold. Even if any one condition might be minimized in isolation, a reasonable jury could find that their combination, especially during prolonged lockdowns, amounted to unconstitutional punishment of a pretrial detainee.
Would you agree that there is no 14th Amendment due process requirement that a jail find the best solution to a problem like COVID, or one with the most satisfactory balance between recreation time and health protection?
Yes, Your Honor. We certainly agree that there's no requirement under the 14th Amendment that the jail enact a perfect response to COVID. The standard is whether its response was excessive in relation to a legitimate goal of curbing the pandemic. However, the deference that's owed to the county is not unbounded. And here the record viewed favorably supports 26 and a half hours of rotational confinement for a 7 month long period, which very much resembles the types of lockdowns that this court has previously recognized, not under COVID, but under other security situations, to raise tribal issues, including at times even under the Eighth Amendment's higher standard of protection. So at that point, we believe there's enough evidence sufficient for at least a tribal jury question as to excessiveness. And Mays v. Dart is also an example of how deference is not unbounded during COVID, although it is still certainly wide-ranging for the facility. In that case, this court upheld, in part, a preliminary injunction regarding the jail's conditions during COVID for pretrial detainees.
On his conditions of confinement claim, does Mr. Lee need to show that he was deprived of a basic human need? I'll tell you the reason I'm asking that question. He makes a lot of observations about conditions that there's no question are concerning and troubling. For example, the human waste in the sanitation closets and things like that. But if he needs to show that he was deprived of a basic human need, how does his observations about some of those conditions translate or apply against that standard?
I don't believe he needs to demonstrate a deprivation of a single human need, but the court can look at the totality of conditions that Mr. Lee experienced, and if in totality those conditions amount to objectively unreasonable ones that would qualify as punishment, again, viewed objectively, then that would be sufficient to find for Mr. Lee. So some cases that might be helpful for thinking about this would be Hardiman. There, this court found objectively unreasonable conditions where the jail shut off water for 3 days, causing feces to build up in cell toilets, which in turn attracted insects. Mr. Lee alleges disabled toilets for a week plus, so longer than the duration in Hardiman, in addition to mold, broken plumbing, pest infestations, and inadequate cleaning supplies, again, compounded during 20-hour daily lockdowns. So we think that's comparable to or more prolonged than the situation in Hardiman. And to the extent this court is inclined to find that a single identifiable human need must be deprived, this court has certainly recognized that prolonged exposure to human feces in close quarters qualifies as something that is not constitutionally tolerable. This court's decisions in Gray v. Hardy and Budd v. Motley are also helpful. In Gray, this court recognized that the lack of access to adequate cleaning supplies, together with other unsanitary conditions, including pest infestations, broken windows, could amount to unconstitutional confinement when considered cumulatively, even under the Eighth Amendment. Similarly, in Budd, there the plaintiff alleged mold, broken sinks, poor ventilation, cell overcrowding, and the court noted that no single issue may have been sufficient alone, but in combination, that was sufficient to state a valid 14th Amendment claim. And if possible, I would like to reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
Yeah, you may do so. Okay, thank you. Ms. Mills, nice to see you.
Good morning, Your Honors. Actually, oh my gosh, good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the court. The only claims that we are dealing with in this action are Monell claims. And so to sort of orient all of the allegations, it's important to remember that there has to be some municipal action that directly caused an alleged constitutional deprivation. And then past that, we have to get to the point where there needs to be evidence that the county, a policymaker, consciously disregarded a known or obvious risk through either an express policy, an act of a final policymaker, or this widespread pattern of similar incidents. We do not.
Okay. Let's start here. The jail may have a written policy that they will not turn off the water to punish inmates for flooding their cells. But Lee claims that this is what the jail personnel do. Why wouldn't that be just a factual dispute? In other words, aren't you asking us to believe your policy of Lee's assertion of the facts of which he has personal knowledge?
So I understand that Lee may have personal knowledge of the fact that water was turned off, but Lee has no personal knowledge of the reasons why the water was turned off. And on that element, the reasons why, the record does not contain any evidence suggesting that they were turned off for some punitive purpose. And instead, the record shows that there were frequent flooding incidents. I believe the longest one was the 44 hours that was mentioned, where an entire floor of the facility was flooded to the point that it was going through ceilings and it was so damaged that an entire floor had to be closed off. So there's no, although Mr. Lee may believe that that's a reason, and in reading through some of his grievances, he makes claims like, I understand that it was turned off because of flooding, but I feel that it's being directed to me personally. He doesn't say those words verbatim, but that's kind of the gist of his complaint. And ultimately, because of the way that buildings and plumbing are, and I'm no plumbing expert, but there isn't a way to simply shut off water to very localized areas while plumbers come and work on it. It's just kind of the nature of how plumbing works in large facilities like that. So while I think the responses to many of his grievances apologized and sorry for the inconvenience, that's simply all it was. It was an inconvenience that was unnecessarily avoidable or could not be avoided because of the fact that they've got to get plumbers in there to fix what's been caused by other inmates. And so while I understand he may feel like he's being punished for the actions of other people, it's just kind of part and parcel of living in a communal area with many other people, some of whom do bad things, and the consequences have to be dealt with as quickly and as sanitarily as possible. And I think that, Judge Rovner, your question kind of goes to a lot of what Mr. Lee's allegations boil down to, is his belief. He felt personally that he was not getting the medical care that he thought he was entitled to, or that he thought was the best course of treatment.
Well, let's...
Do you know if he was evaluated by a psychiatrist or a psychologist to see what his needs were? Do you have any understanding of all that?
I don't have a specific understanding as to evaluation by a psychologist. I do know that the WellPath folks did get all of his records from the VA because he was saying, I was receiving certain treatment through the VA, I want that here. So they did get his records from the VA, and upon review, WellPath responded and said, you know, what you're saying you should be receiving is not reflected in your VA medical records. So
there was an additional comment in relation to the mental health treatment that long-term therapy is not provided. That sure sounds like a policy to me. And, you know, with Manel, the very first thing we do is say, is there a constitutional violation? So let's kind of go through the steps in Manel. Would it be a constitutional violation to have a blanket rule that you're not going to have long-term therapy for mental health issues?
I think it could potentially be a Monell violation if it was shown that this gentleman was found to need that, or that that would be advisable. Mm-hmm. And then there was a full-scale blanket prohibition. Now, in this case,
would it be unconstitutional for a jail to say we just don't provide long-term therapy even if a prisoner's medical records indicated a need for long-term therapy?
I think that there would need to be some, at least under the 14th Amendment, objectively reasonable basis as to why that's not being provided, or there needs to be some kind of alternative treatment provided to people. Perhaps it's not through WellPath, but through some additional provider. In this case, we didn't really drill into that because WellPath was the provider of the medical stuff. They were receiving the medical complaints, requests, grievances. They were responding to them. But in this case, there's simply no evidence that he was ever found to need any type of treatment that he didn't receive, let alone long-term therapy.
Exactly by whom?
Excuse me?
Exactly by whom?
He was at Milwaukee County Jail for 2.5 years. Two and a half years. Long time. He was in pretty constant contact with the WellPath medical team. They did get his medical records, like I mentioned. He was getting injections for long-term pain. It's not as if he was not getting treatment. So he was constantly evaluated. He was getting constant FaceTime with medical professionals. And there's simply no record that anybody said, particularly to somebody on the jail side of things, as opposed to the healthcare side of things, we believe that this gentleman needs some type of treatment, but it's not something we provide. Or we believe that this gentleman would benefit from long-term therapy, and as you know, that's a carve-out in our contract. There's just no evidence whatsoever that anybody diagnosed him with something and then said, we think that this is recommended, this is necessary, anything like that, that he didn't receive.
But I'm still wondering here, and maybe I just missed it. Was Lee evaluated by mental health care professional at intake to see what his mental health needs were?
I believe he was. That's the standard practice at Milwaukee County.
You believe he was, is it in the record?
No. The detailed records of his intake, his medical records, none of that was put into the record. It's just his grievances, the appeals, the responses from medical, from many other non-medical grievances that he filed. But his medical records are not in the record.
His medical records are not in the record?
That's correct. You look like you have another question, so I don't want to go on.
I'm sorry. I'm just a bit flummoxed by that. Yeah.
While we're on the medical care, could I ask you a question there?
Absolutely.
You all seem to take the position in your brief that with the medical care being contracted out to WellPath, that there can't be liability for the county unless the county was on some kind of notice or had knowledge that there was a failure to provide care in some kind of in a particular area. And you go so far in your briefs as to say that, you know, the linchpin of all of this is notice. Is that really your legal position, that absent notice to the county, regardless of what was transpiring at WellPath, that there cannot be Monell liability, just full stop?
I don't even think we need to go that far, because there would need to be some notice. We could say there needs to be notice to WellPath, but here there wasn't.
Yeah, so I just want to make sure on this, because it surprised me. Maybe I read it wrong, but you seem to stake out a pretty stark position in your brief on notice. So if we hypothesize 10 pretrial detainees at the Milwaukee County Jail, and they all had cardiac care needs, and the jail took the position, or WellPath, I'm sorry, took the position as a categorical matter, we do not provide cardiac care in any way, shape, or form. That would seem to be unconstitutional to me.
Yes.
You agree?
I agree with that. Okay. I think it is incumbent.
And would that, if that was WellPath's policy or practice or custom, would your position be that there cannot be Monell liability unless that information was somehow given to the county unless the county somehow had notice that that was WellPath's practice, custom, policy?
Yes, because, and I think that is where you get to the contract wrangling. I think it's incumbent upon a municipality to contract for, if you're going to go through third parties like so many do, you as the county have that obligation to ensure all of the needs are met that you have a constitutional obligation to provide. And so if you are getting a medical provider who says, I'll provide everything, but I'm not going to touch heart stuff, that's a problem. That's an obvious
gap. Well, okay, so it's easy for me to see if there's a contractual provision that says we will treat everyone at the Milwaukee County Jail for everything except cardiac conditions. But what if, as a matter of practice, as a matter of custom, they just did not, and the county could accurately say, we had no idea. Your point there is that there can be no Monell liability? Because you would just contract and make sure that your contracts weren't too specific.
Right. And I'm not a contract lawyer, but I think that there still has to be some notice to the county of a problem.
Do you think that, first of all, you have an obligation to provide medical care, right?
Correct, undisputably.
So I had the feeling also reading the brief that what was being said was that you could outsource to a third party and then that's it. In other words, you could stick your head in the sand.
Same question. That's exactly my question. That's the impression your brief left. Maybe you didn't intend it.
And I apologize if that's the impression it gave. That's not what we are saying. You can contract for the services, but you can't contract away the liability. The policies and procedures, whether they are of WellPath or of Milwaukee County, they become the policies of Milwaukee County through the fact that Milwaukee County is required to provide these services. And regardless of whether you've contracted with somebody to provide those or not, it is your obligation and you need to be taking steps to ensure it's happening.
Okay, now what you just said seems different to me than your brief. Yeah. What you just said seems legally defensible because no part of your most recent statement included anything about notice to the county or knowledge on the county's part.
And I still think that there is some point at which, in order to fix a problem or address it, there has to be notice to somebody of a problem. And I think coming back to this particular case, there's zero evidence that this gentleman was not getting adequate care from WellPath. To WellPath, to Milwaukee County, to anybody. There's no suggestion that any of his medical complaints were anything other than him wanting to see his VA providers him wanting to try.
So I understand that. When we write an opinion, the rule statement, if you will, that we articulate is of real concern to us because the case is, of course, important to the county. It's important to Mr. Lee, but we got to think about it with respect to the next group of parties as well.
And I think in this particular case, there is simply no evidence to support that underlying premise of his Monell claim. There's no underlying constitutional violation. There's no evidence of a pattern or practice that could put anybody on notice.
Go ahead. Sorry.
No, go ahead.
After you.
Thank you. I still am left with a feeling that the county thinks or thought it could avoid liability by outsourcing its health care to a third party. And that's a worry for me.
And that is not the position we're taking. We are not saying that because WellPath was contracted to provide medical care, the county can never be liable for medical Monell claims.
Let's talk about this particular case.
In this particular case, The evidence is that this gentleman had complaints, but none of them were essentially connected to reality. He didn't like what he was receiving as care, but that didn't mean he wasn't receiving adequate care. And I know my time has expired.
How do we know that if we don't even know for certain that he was evaluated by a psychologist or a psychiatrist? How can we know this?
Well, I think that this comes back to Rule 56 and his burden to put the evidence in the record to support his claim that he wasn't. And what we have shown in the record is that he was, and that his complaints were just merely disagreements about...
Where in the record have you shown that it was? That's what I'm trying to get to.
Sure. So if you look at... I don't know if it's supplemental appendix or separate appendix. Excuse me. So for instance, on the very first page of the packet of grievances, it's supplemental appendix page 107. This is a request that Mr. Lee sent in September 2021, and he's talking about the fact that he wanted more different services that were similar to what he had been receiving through the VA. And WellPath responds and says that they did get his records, and they said, per a review of your electronic medical record, you released your VA records. We received them. It indicates medication was prescribed. You were not admitted to the jail until the following year. It's been at least a year since you've been prescribed that. If you don't have a current prescription, no medication will be prescribed. Mental health services at this facility consist of crisis intervention, counseling, medication management. Long-term therapy is not provided. And then, but there's nothing in the medical records from the VA that suggests he needs long-term therapy. And so another similar one is the one on the following page, 108. He's talking about...
Go ahead.
He's talking about nerve pain. She states, or he, there are interventions available to assist with nerve pain. It doesn't appear you've tried those medications. Please submit a sick call request if you're willing to try these interventions. In other words, he says the only interventions available are mental health medications that do little to nothing for pain or prevention. And then he talks about TENS machine, which is like shock therapy. So basically he's saying, I don't want to try those things. I know better. That's not going to work. And you've got medical saying, well, these are therapies, modalities that can help. If you're willing to try those, let us know.
But in that first response that you read, the very last sentence, mental health services at this facility consist of crisis intervention, brief counseling, medication management. We already said he's not going to have any medication. Providing written materials to assist with mental health. Long-term therapy is not provided, such as this is in a prison setting. If you've got someone with PTSD and a TBI, I'm not sure on this record that we can say that he established that he needed long-term therapy, but that sure sounds like a policy, and it sounds like your policy through WellPath, and it sounds like a pretty problematic policy.
And to that, I would say all we have as evidence of that being a policy is this one response from somebody from WellPath in a record. We don't have anything else that suggests that this gentleman didn't receive mental health care, that he deteriorated in any way, that he, for instance, needed to go on suicide watch because he was deteriorating, that he had a specific medication that he needed.
Was there anything in the summary judgment to say, whoa, that's not our policy?
Yes, Captain, or I want to say his title is Captain, but Duckert. I don't know that it went specifically to long-term therapy, but it is in the record, separate appendix starting on SA-72, and it specifically states that... and it would be on page SA-76, that it is Milwaukee County policy and practice, this is paragraph 24, through its contract with WellPath, that Milwaukee County jail inmates receive routine medical and mental health care and treatment, as well as emergency medical care. And then the next paragraph, it's Milwaukee County jail policy and practice that inmates who need health care or specialty care that is beyond the resources available in the facility are referred for outside or specialty medical care that is coordinated by WellPath. And then the next one, it is MCJ policy and practice that inmates with chronic diseases or special needs receive all necessary treatment through an enrollment in a chronic disease program or referrals to specialists. And I do know that he had submitted a grievance about not being part of the chronic disease program. I believe it was for his nerve pain. But the decisions about enrollment in chronic disease programs are something that we have to leave to the trained medical professionals.
Okay. Hearing no further questions, thank you, Ms. Mills.
You're welcome.
Okay. Ms. LaBelle, you had a couple minutes there for rebuttal if you'd like to use it.
So we'd like to begin where the court just left off with its discussion of Mr. Lee's healthcare claims. And it's important to remember, as this court well knows, that at summary judgment, we draw inferences in Mr. Lee's favor. At this point, the record reflects that Milwaukee County Jail, by its own admission, had a policy that it would not provide long-term therapy to its residents. And my friend on the other side repeatedly references sort of what Mr. Lee did not show in the record. But what's important to remember while we're drawing inferences in his favor, that as it stands, there's no evidence in the record that his medical records were evaluated by medical professionals who then came to the medical determination that Mr. Lee does not require therapy or a particular medication. And instead, the county asserts its policy is to not prescribe any medication unless it had been prescribed within 30 days pre-intake. So ultimately, where the record stands is that at intake, Mr. Lee entered Milwaukee County Jail with serious conditions, including a traumatic brain injury, intermittent blackouts, serious PTSD, and he had stated multiple times at Supplemental Appendix 136, for example, that he has the legal right to access adequate treatment, and none had been provided to him in 18 months, which a grievance, by the way, that the county simply closed with no comment given in response. He stated that he made numerous attempts to obtain health care, and the county had yet to follow up. At Supplemental Appendix 14, at Supplemental Appendix 26, there were zero attempts to provide access to or any meaningful semblance of care to him. That he had been neglected since intake in December 2020. So ultimately, viewing the record in his favor, this court is left with serious questions about what the county did not provide to someone who was potentially in great need of mental health treatment, and we believe those are issues that a jury is entitled to assess. And seeing my time has expired, thank you.
Okay, you're quite welcome. Thank you, Ms. LaBelle. Ms. LaBelle, I have a note here, and I'm well aware from being with the case, as are my colleagues, that you accepted this appeal on appointment.
Yes.
We very much appreciate that. You've done a very fine job for Mr. Lee, Ms. Kostanek. Thanks to you and your firm as well. The court very much appreciate it. Appreciate your advocacy. And Ms. Mills, as always, thanks to you. We appreciate it. We'll take the appeal under advisement.